Okay, good morning. Lovely to see you all. We are on Daf Chaf Aleph. We're going to start at the bottom of Chaf Amud Bet. We just got the yellow line. So those of you who have two sheets, it's going to be, it says 40 on the top right, the bottom yellow bit. Today we're going to move from Mishnah 3 of the third parak to 4 and 5. And we are going to get deeper and deeper into the human person. And it is, I should say, it's a given in Jewish thought that what we think matters. Who does it matter to, what we think? Well, who cares about what's going on in my head?
God.
So ultimately, we kind of come in knowing that God cares what I think about. The novelty here is that society cares about what you think about too. You could be an incredibly religious libertarian and say, of course, what I think about matters, but that's between me and God and society. You can go jump in a lake. It's none of your business what's going on in my head. And what Jewish tradition is going to be continuing to innovate here is that actually what goes on in your head is not just God's business, but it is punishable or enforceable or pertinent to the public too. And in the context in which the Mishnah is speaking, we will punish you on the basis of what's going on in your head. And this may sound, I don't know if primitive is the right word, it may sound old-fashioned, let's say, but this happens in America all the time, where there are punishments for what's going on in your head. Give me an example of where there's a punishment for what's going on in your head in America.
Manslaughter, murder.
Right. So if the only thing that happens is something in your head, I don't know of an American law that can be enforced because you thought something. But if there is an act, right, so 1984 does not yet exist in the United States. But if you do something physically, the government will use what's going in your head to add to your punishment. One example is hate crime. One example is straightforwardly manslaughter or murder. We care what your intention is. It's not just the result that matters. You graffiti somebody's property with just like, ha ha, you're an idiot. What is that? Damages, I don't know what the word is, but that's, you've damaged someone's property. If you put a swastika and say, hey, you're right, it's a misdemeanor. If you put on your graffiti, I hate Jews, or we've got a recording of you doing it saying, I hope this scares all the Jews away, that can be elevated to a hate crime on the basis of what you're thinking. And when this was initiated in legislation, there were concerns that we're turning into the thought police, meaning I get that it's not good, but we shouldn't be punishing for what's going on in people's heads. And there was a back and forth. So in American law, we think about what's going on in the head all the time. We said that a number of the indictments that are flowing through the justice system right now, it is going to fall on the government to prove that the accused was thinking something at the time, had the intention to do this at the time, especially like lying before Congress. Anyone who's been charged for lying, you have to prove that they knew that they were lying. The example of Fox News we noted last week, or maybe we didn't note it last week, what gave Fox comfort going into this a few months ago was you have to prove, for the case of libel, you have to prove that, number one, it's not true, and number two, I knew it was not true when I was saying it. And it's impossible to get into somebody's head unless you have a paper trail of them saying, I know this is wrong and I'm going to say it anyway. And that was, of course, why Fox ended up settling, because they got their hand in all the texts and things like that. Which is, for the record, why I never put anything on paper, because the government has access to everything eventually. And that's... Say again? That's what I meant. I don't put it in writing. It was around 2015 when the Hillary Clinton email scandal came out, when the whole country was reading all her emails, that I became very conscious that I obviously don't have the public interest of Hillary Clinton. Not yet. When I run for president, even though I'm not eligible for the position. I became heavily conscious that nothing's private. Nothing is private. If somebody is malicious, or if there's an accident, or if China hacks Google or something, everything was ever written will be in the public domain. And if there is somebody who does care about what I've written, they'll search it and they'll find something. So I never put anything in writing, even in private, if I think I wouldn't be able to defend this before any of the people involved, which does limit what I put in writing, but makes me feel better. But it does make my head crowded. So either way, we're going to see that as we progress through this perek, we're getting closer and closer to how much the government in Jewish thought ought to care about what's going on. So far, we've had you can't have consensual relationships with other people if the Torah deems them to be socially problematic on some level, or just prohibited for whatever reason. Eating certain foods are going to be, it's just food, I'm just eating food, no one's getting hurt. We're saying, yes, this is damaging to the public. This food I'm allowed to eat, but not yet. I'm eating Maaseh Sheni outside Yerushalayim, or I'm eating the Korban Pesach too quickly. That's also the government's business. You're doing something that is permitted, but too hastily or in the wrong place. We've said ripping out your hair. Again, it's my hair. Doesn't matter if you're ripping it out because it's an act of mourning. So already we're getting close to what's going on your head and in your head. Why are you ripping it out? And we said cutting your skin in response to mourning is deeply problematic. That's where we're up to. And the Mishnah we'll get to today, the first one is going to talk about tattooing, which is, you know, I get hair is kind of external, cutting skin. This is inside my skin. You know, if you were going to say it's my body, you'd say, government, get your hand out of my body. The Mishnah is going to say, actually, we have a deep interest in what's going on, even in your body, and we're going to prohibit tattoos. And then we're going to get to the case Jerry mentioned last week, kind of the famous instance that is discussed from Marco, which is you can do one thing and be liable for eight punishments at the same time, which is not because there are eight prohibitions on eating a sheretz, which we dealt with, but because you're a Kohen and a Nazir, and it's Yom Tov, and it's Kilayim, and there's two oxes involved, and you're pulling once in the field. So you do one thing, and you get eight punishments. And that sounds like just an accumulation of events, but what it actually seems to be doing is saying, we're in your head. We punish you for a single act, but for eight different things, as long as you are warned for all eight of them, because you're conscious of them. So you're mental violation is at the forefront of what we're concerned about. So at the bottom, 40, or Chaf Amud Bet at the bottom, Hamaseret Srita Achat, we said if you have one incision in your body in response to mourning, you are held liable. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught. Veseret, it says an incision. Yachol afilu sarat al beidosh nafal v'sinatosh rabayam. You might think that you are liable if you make an incision in yourself because you've had financial loss, your house collapsed or a boat sunk, but you're not liable for that. So this is, again, you're only liable if this is an act of mourning. Talmud Loma Lenefesh, that's why it says for Seret, Lenefesh, if you make an incision because of the loss of a soul, Enochayv Alamet Bilvad, that's the only thing that we punish for. Umanayin Lemesaret Chavish Shrit Alamet Achat Shulchayv Kol Achvecha. Now, how do we know that if you make an incision five times because of one person, I mean, you're really aggrieved or bereaved, and you cut yourself five times, you are liable for each one. Tamlova seret, and it says an incision, which makes it sound like for each and every incision, you will be held liable. Lachayva kol srita v'srita. Rabbi Yosef, menayin maseret srita achat al heimetim. How do I know if you do one incision, but on five different meitim, shulchayva kol achavecha, that you are liable for five? And so again, we're now in your head. You did one act, but for five people. And this was the so to speak, riddle we had last week of 6 million series of malchus for one act. If you cut yourself over the Shoah, like I had all 6 million in mind, it was, you're liable 6 million times for one act. That's the riddle. How can you be chayv for 6 million lavim in one act? And he said, how do you know if you do it for five, you're in trouble? Time with lomel and nefesh, because it says in the singular for a soul, which makes it sound like l'chayva kol nefesh v'nefesh for each and every soul. And then the Gemara says, hold on a minute, you're using these words for too many things. You said l'nefesh teaches you that it's only an act of mourning, but if a boat goes down, it doesn't matter. And then you think, oh, and l'nefesh teaches you for each and every person you have in mind. You can't double dip exegetically. V'ha apid ke leveto. We use that word already, the Gemara says, for determining this only as a prohibition in the context of mourning. Chafal af amad alef at the top. Kasav Rabbi Yosi. Rabbi Yosi, so we've got a different answer. It's not lenefesh. That's not how he knows that you're chai for each and every person you have in mind. Rabbi Yosi holds srita ugedida achat hi. He holds that the prohibitions of srita ugedida. If anybody has an arch goal, it'd be helpful to see. What's the difference between one is an incision and the other is a cut? Is that what they say? Sri Tagadi da Achat. He believes that these prohibitions of Al Tid Godadu and Al Yisareit are essentially the same thing. Divhatam Lemate, and it says in the context of Al Tid Godadu Lemate, says don't cut yourself over a dead person. So the assumption is there's a Gzera Shavan that applies here too. And you're right, Lenefesh means for each and every one. But the way. Right, it's a scratch or an incision. Oh, well, so that's what we're going to come to now. And if you look in the top line of Rashi, as you just pointed to, Rabbi Yossi thinks they're the same thing, meaning Tavaru ben Bayad ben Bekli. He thinks they're both the same thing, whether you use a Kli or a hand, it's the same thing. Amar Shmuel, Shmuel is going to say, Hamasaret Bekli Chayev. If you make an incision with a Kli, a utensil, meaning a razor or a knife or something like that, and forgive the graphic nature of this, you're chayev, liable. Meitve, but hold on, how can Shmuel say that? Srito gedida achat hi, there is a teaching of an Tanaitic provenance that says, Srito gedida, the same thing with one exception. Srita b'yadu gedida pekli, srita is an incision made with your hand, with your nail. The gedida is something with a utensil. So how can he say that if you are making an incision with a utensil, you're liable? Hudramogiosi, he teaches like Rabbi Yossi, who we just had in the top line, saying they're exactly the same thing. There's no difference between Gdida and Srita. Why they're taught in different words in different places, I guess for another time. But that's his view. Tanakame de Rabbi Yochanan, it was taught before Rabbi Yochanan. Almeit, if somebody is doing an incision in their skin in mourning, ben biyad ben bikli, whether it is with their hand or with the utensil, chayev, they're liable. Al avodah zara, b'yad chayev b'kli padra. But if they're cutting their skin because this is an act of worship to a foreign deity, if they use their hand, they're chayev. If they use a utensil, they are not. Va'ibcha k'tiv. The Gemara says, hold on a minute. How can Rabbi Yochanan say that in the context of idolatry, it's only if you use your hand you're liable? Look at the pasuk itself. This is in Melachim Aleph. It says, v'yitgodudu, they made incisions in themselves, k'mishpatam, as is their way. B'charavot from Rachim, with swords and with spears. It sounds like using a kli is what's used in idolatry. Ela ema b'yad pato b'kli chayev. It's like, oh yeah, fine. Switch it around that you're liable if you use a kli and not of a hand. Go on. No? And at which point the commentators say, this doesn't now mean we've said if you use a kli, you're chayev avodah zarah. It just means depends on the context. If idolatry is done with kelim, that's a problem. If it's done with your hand, that's a problem. Basically, imitating foreign worship by cutting yourself is as problematic as tearing yourself in mourning. And again, if we had more time, we could spend time thinking about why ripping your skin over mourning a human being is criminal. Ripping your skin over losing all your property is not criminal. What the distinction is there and why the Torah is enforcing that. But we continue. V'chayv al arosh, and we said, you are liable not only for pulling hair out or cutting yourself over dead, but for cutting the corners of your head. Do any of you, like when you're in high school, cover this material? Like you can't pace, you shouldn't do. Anyone remember which part of the head they told you can't cut your pace up to? Did they give a description? Cheekbones?
Upper cheekbones.
There you go. So that's helpful, because what we're about to see is, and say, where is it? And then say, oh, he just went like that. Meaning we're going to have a lot of illustrative pedagogy here. So chayv al arosh, you are chayv for removing the corners of the head. Mechayv Rav Sheshes ben Pirkei Reisha. And what Rav Sheshes would do, he would point to the joints between the head. Okay, I'm not sure that helps us reading this, but there seems to be an embedded point about teaching that visual aids, though intellectuals may look down on them as cheapening the material, are necessary and deeply effective ways of teaching, because we all remember images and pictures far more easily than we do abstract details, and that's what Rosheshes would do. And we said, in terms of the beard, there are five corners, two on each side and one in the middle. And last time I said that you know, it's this, this, and this, so that's one, two, three, four, five. There is a debate about where these are. Some people think the five is literally the corner of the jawbone, some people think it's underneath, some people think it's on top. And in theory, if you deep down believed, I know it's this, this, and this, you could use like a razor in between those bits and just keep the five patches. Nobody does that. And the assumption is, because there's ambiguity, we treat the whole face as if it's one of the corners because we don't know. There's a debate about, what about the neck? Thank you. The neck underneath, because maybe the corners are underneath rather than on top. And maybe I'm wrong. I have to speak to a dermatologist. I think the skin on the neck is like different to the skin on the face. Is that right? There you go. Good. Right. Meaning I've noticed when I use, when I'm using an electric shaver, when I used to use an electric shaver on my face, I don't think my face would ever get cut. But when I was using an electric shaver under here, even like just a normal electric shaver, I would often end up bleeding on my neck. I don't know if the skin is like looser or maybe I just don't know how to shave properly.
No comment.
Yeah, well, consult afterwards. But so there's some people who won't shave under here at all. We'll get to that. We've got to that. So, Mechaber Rosh Hashanah has been Pirkei Dikna. So what would Rosh Hashanah do when people said, what are these five corners? He would point to the five corners on his face. Thank you. Rebbe Elazar Omeim Natlan and Rebbe Elazar in the Mishnah said, if you cut all five corners, you only get punished once. Why? Kesav Echad Lavu, because he thought it was one prohibition. Thank you. As opposed to five. Ve'enu Chayav Etshlenu Batar, and we had in the Mishnah the view that said the only prohibition is using a razor, which is why people use electric shavers, or you can use scissors. There are people who are machmen and say, I'm not going to use anything on my face at all. There are some Hasidic groups that won't ever cut the shave the beard, and they'll kind of... I remember I had a teacher in high school who looked like quite a close beard, and then one day he was teaching us about this, and he said, let me show you, and he like undid a knot, and like it fell to the floor. They like, I don't know how, I don't know how you clean that, how you maintain that, but either way, he had that rolled up under there. And you can't use a tar, but that's only when you're using the beard of the beard rather than the head. On the head, one can't cut close with anything. So using an electric shaver in this area is problematic. There's a debate how long the hair has to be left. Anyone have been given guidance how long there has to be left in the temple area? No one had, like, been given like a rule of thumb? Say again? Right, so different people have said different things. The my understanding, I might be wrong, is one of the other local rabbis here tells people you shouldn't get a haircut under number two. Even like going here, it shouldn't be lower than number two. I confess I've had haircuts that are shorter than that. I've had one and a half. The general policy or principle that I've followed, Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rav Shechter has and others, is that if you can hold it between your fingers, it's good enough. And after getting a one, you can still hold it between your fingers. So you just have to have some hair there. But the face, it can be even shorter than that. It just, you can't use a razor on your face. So I don't know why, but I've never been offered, like, you know, in the barber here, they have like a knife they'll use to like sometimes. So I've never been offered that here. But in England, growing up, they'd always say, would you like the knife, sir? I said, for what? And the answer is, I've said you can only use it on the back. So they like use it at the back here or like over here. But on the face, even though you can have a close shave, one shouldn't use a razor. Tan Rabbanan, the rabbi said, Fazekanam Liugalechu, how do we know it's only a tar and not scissors like here on the temples? So Tan Rabbanan, first word on the is tar. The rabbi said, Fazekanam Liugalechu, you can't cut the corners of your beard. Yachol, you might think it says you can't shave. Afilu Gilchub and Misperam Yechav, you might think, well, you can't shave, you can't even use scissors. That's why it adds, you shall not destroy. Meaning scissors doesn't destroy the hair, it just makes it close. So you need to be it needs to be a destructive shave. Ilo Tashkit, if it had only said don't destroy, Yachol Imlakta Bamagarini Yachav, you might think you can't use like these form it's called planes or something, which is like a kind of cutting instrument that you don't usually use for shaving, if you use for like shaving wood rather than your face. You might think, oh well, I can't use that on my face. Probably not a good idea anyway. But you might think it says, Lo Tashkar, I can't use that. Tom Lama Yogalecho, that's why it says Yolo Galecho. It has to be a usual shaving procedure that destroys your face. And the Gemara says, Ha Ketzad, what does this mean? You can't shave and you shouldn't destroy. Giluch Shesh Bashkata, a form of shaving that is destructive. Havyom Zetar, that is the razor. In the Mishnah, we had Rebbe Elazar have the view that actually using planes on your face is problematic too. And the Gemara is now going to say that that's like an in-between view. How can you just ban planes and not scissors? Or how can you ban planes at all? Manavshach. Either way, the Gemara says, first one on the line is Gamir. E Gamir Gzeri Shava. If you learn the Gzeri Shava of Lo Tashchit, Libaytar, you should be only including tar. Ilo gam gzereshav. You don't learn the gzereshava from lotar. Shchit misparim namilo. You shouldn't. You should be including scissors too. If it says lo yugal lechu, that should include everything. If you include lotar shchit, it should only include destructive things. La olam gam gzereshava ksara haninami gilochavti. He learns the gzereshava of lo yugal lechu, but he thinks that using planes is a normal thing to do. Yeah, fine. You only use it for wood. I use anything on my face. Full stop. So we've now discussed cutting the corners of the head, cutting the corners of the beard, ripping hair out of your head in mourning, tearing your skin out of mourning. And all of this is kind of surface level bodily behaviors. And we're now going to go even deeper. Next mission, fourth mission of the Perek. There are 10 in this Perek, and we'll have like a quick series of them over the next few, couple of dapim. Hakotev ktubat kaka. If you inscribe writing of tattoos, you are liable. Katav lo kaka, if you write on your skin but it's not a tattoo, or kikav lo katav, or you make impressions but you don't write anything, enu chayev, you are not liable. Ad shiichtav yikaka, until you do the two together. You have to inscribe and you have to, in that, have that inscription pushed into your skin. I don't know how tattoos work. Is it just injecting color, pigment under your skin? Because skin falls off, so I don't know why it doesn't just fall off eventually.
Is it steeper than...
It's beneath the epidermis?
Yes.
And that part of the body never replenishes itself?
It replenishes itself, but it doesn't necessarily dissolve the pigment in that replenishment.
Oh, interesting. So the pigment kind of transitions into whatever comes through. Okay, interesting. So that has to be both together. And so it sounds like it has to be writing. Makes it sound like you get one of those big snakes from 24 or any other military... television series put on your back. That's not writing, that's what it sounds like.
Emojis.
Or put emojis. Is that writing? Good question. So you're not chayv until you've written a tattoo. Whether it's with your hand or with an instrument or anything that makes an impression. Bottom line, full stop, is it has to be writing in order for it to be a biblical prohibition. There is still rabbinic prohibitions to have any kind of tattoo. But there are Now, I'd say openings for, I think we mentioned a couple of times ago, sometimes when there are radiotherapy treatments that are very localized, they will want to put a tattoo on the body so they have a permanent record of where they're applying the radiation so that they don't, you know. And if they say, I'll put a pen mark, if you shower, it comes off, they might put the radiation somewhere else and it won't be effective. And this question often comes to rabbinic halachists and say, am I allowed to get this tattoo done? And they'll say, you know, is it necessary? Is it not necessary? And they say, if it wasn't necessary, I wouldn't be asking you. And then back and forth. And there is room for that to be made. There is a question, should you have it removed afterwards? Because it sounds like that there is a view that just having a tattoo on you is problematic. The question was actually brought to Rav Zilberstein, I mentioned, last time, about survivors of the Shoah who have the numbers tattooed on. As somebody said, I know it's rabbinic practice to remove tattoos. Do I have an obligation to remove these numbers off my arm? And the piece goes back and forth and eventually settles on, actually, you have an obligation to keep it for the preserving the memory of the horror, and there's a biblical mitzvah for that that overrides the rabbinic will to remove it. So, you know, these kind of somewhat abstract details have pertinent applications. So, Rav Shimon bar Yehuda, Rav Shimon Omer. So, we've got Rav Shimon bar Yehuda says the name of Rav Shimon. Einu chayv shichtav shem shamet Hashem. So, not only does it have to be writing, it has to be the name of God written on your skin. So, you can write, "Hello, my name is," and that's not a problem. As long as it's a whole sentence, but you don't have the name of God, Shneemar, and this, he's not going to settle on that. That's how we're reading it. As it says, "Ktuvet ka'aka lo titnu bachem." And the writing of a tattoo you shall not put in you. That's why the rabbis read out you should remove it. It says you shouldn't have them on you. Ani Hashem, I'm the Lord your God. And that last phrase, I'm the Lord your God, is like, well, we're familiar with that. We know that. Why does it say that here? It says you shall not write a tattoo on you that I am God, is how it sounds like. Which would be prohibiting what, if you read that literally? The prohibition is celebrating God. It's like an odd moment. God is one on your arm.
Defacing God.
Right. Presumably, we're going to have to go. And also, to say Ani Hashem might be suggesting that I am God. And again, what we're coming to is you don't own your body. And if you put any tattoo on your body, what you're essentially saying is, this is mine, which is, in essence, the heretical claim that I have a divine right to my body and you don't. And so just saying Ani Hashem is what all tattooists seem to be doing, saying it's my territory, it's my body, I do what I want. And we seem to be saying, I'm afraid not. The Gemara, Amalei Rav Acha Bar Rav Ravashi. So Rava said, sorry, Rav Acha, Rava's son, said to Ravashi, Ad Sheikh Tov Ani Hashem Mamash, you really think that you're only liable if you write, I am Hashem on your arm? There's a very literalist reading of this pasuk, which seems odd. Amalei, lo, no, that's not what the Mishnah means. Kedetani bar Kapara, it means what bar Kapara taught. Einu chayv v'shitach v'shem avodah zarah, it means if you write an idolatrous name. Shne'emah, what does the verse say? Kedivat kakalot nubachem, you shall not write a tattoo on your arm. Ani Hashem, I'm your God. Ani Hashem v'lo acher. So really, the verse is inverting what we thought it meant and suggesting you can't put idolatrous tattoos on your arm, which apparently was a practice back in the day.
Are they saying that the Mishnah, Rav Shimon ben Yehuda, Mishum Rav Shimon, is wrong, or are they saying we're not understanding his statement?
Good question. I think it's we're not understanding. When it says, An Shichtov Sham et Hashem, what he meant was, until you write there a name of a God. Otherwise, you're right. It seems to be, well, the Mishnah says quite explicitly what it means, and he's saying, An Shichtov et Hashem. Right. Until you write it, write the name, that's what it means. Okay, and we're now going to have a somewhat convoluted complication with two sages of a very similar name. Amr of Malkia, Amr of Adaba Arva. There was a teaching on the part of Rav Malkia, who said, Asar lo la adam, a person cannot, sheiten efer mikla el gabi makato. If you've got a wound, you can't put this burnt ash on it because it'll leave a tint in your skin. And it will look like a tattoo. So we're already on the rabbinic level here because there's no lettering involved. You've just got, let's say, you know, unfortunately you've got a wound on your arm and you start applying this ash lotion to it. It's going to leave a deep stain. It's going to look, you know, if you imagine the images of like Celtic warriors where they don't have any particular writing, just their face is kind of covered in blue. Or you just think of a sports game where people go, maybe they don't do this in America. Do people do that in American football? Turn up covered in colors? Yeah, all right. In England, football, no one turns up normal. So he says you can't apply that even. Amr of Nachum Reader of Yika. And now we're going to say, oh, you're saying this in the name of Rav Malkia? Let's get a few things straight here. Because Shaput, Shvachot, Vagumot, Rav Malkiyu. Rav Malkiyu had the three teachings about the spit, the Shapud. And the Shaput, the teaching about the spit, is whether a spit you roast a Korban Pesach on, whether that becomes mukta after you finish because it's so revolting and disgusting, or whether it's not. Shvachot, teaching about maidservants, which involves the teaching. Do you just do ketubot in Daf Yomi? Or you did Nazir? You did ketubot like 4 years ago now. So there's a, in the middle of ketubot, there's a teaching about if a, when a couple gets married, there are certain expectations on the part of each spouse. And some of the expectation on the part of the wife is to maintain the home and other things. And the Gemara says, or the Mishnah says, there's an exception if she brings in a number of maidservants as part of her dowry. Oh, I was going to say package, which is much better, dowry. That is, she's exempt. And the Gemara says, well, actually, some think she's not exempt. Why? Even if she brings maidservants in, she's an obligation to maintain things in the house. Because? Oh, yes, you got the art scroll there. That's good. I think that's what it has in the note. Because idleness is problematic. So we're not making you do it because you're a woman and you ought to do this unless you've got staff. But, there you go, idleness needs to sin. Because we're concerned that everybody ought to be occupied. And at least in that ancient context, men would be occupied in the field or in the market or something. So we insist that housework is performed by the wife, not because she needs to serve her husband, because she needs to keep herself busy to stop herself from sinning or becoming mischievous. And if you've got staff, you need to be busy nonetheless. So they, and that's a view taken by Rav Malkiyo. The Gumo, and this is about defining the age of maturity. Guma is a pore, P-O-R-E. And there's usually a definition of maturity. You've got to have two hairs in particular places in the body. And he says, even if you've just got the pores that are clearly visible, even if no hair has yet sprouted, you are considered an adult. Rav Malkiyo. That's Rav Malkiyo.
But
Shaput is a spit, where you roast animals on like a spit. And, it, and there's a debate about whether that becomes muktzah once you've finished with it because it's so disgusting. Again, after they finish the shawarma, like sizzle, I don't, most people I know would lick that. So I don't know why it's disgusting, but I mean, I could imagine a whole animal might leave entrails and other things on it that we don't want to think about. So below it, efer mikle gvina, but teachings around below it is a lock of hair, where if you imagine, anyone seen The Last Samurai? Familiar with kind of samurai treatments, they had like a special like ponytail in a section of the head, and there are different faiths where certain areas of the head, the hair is sacred. So there was a debate about whether a Jew can cut the hair of somebody who has these practices if you know they're going to use that lock of hair for worship, or whether you say, I'll give you a haircut, but you're going to have to cut that bit yourself because I can't participate in this worship. Efer mikle, rubbing in ash into your skin, which we've just noted. Ugvina, or whether cheese is biblically prohibited if it's made by non-Jews, or rabbinically prohibited, Rav Malkiyah. That's the teaching of Rav Malkiyah, who we just quoted a moment ago. Rav Papa Amar, Rav Papa said, Matnitin or Matnita, Rav Malkiyah. Rav Papa said, I don't make the distinction based on those three rules or those three rules, but I make the distinction on anything that's commenting on a Mishnah comes from Rav Malkiyah. Shematita, anything coming from an Amora's teaching, Rav Malkiyah. That's Rav Malkiyah. V'simanech, and the way to remember this is Matnita Malkata, the Mishnah is queen. So the Mishnah is Malkata, so anything from the Mishnah is Malkiyah. My Benayo, and the Gemara says, why are you putting so much? What's the difference between whether you identify the cases, you identify the strata of commentary? Ika Benayo Shvachot, and the difference is Shvachot, because for Rav Nachman, Rav Ika, Shvachot, he associates with Malkiyah, but that's really commenting on a Mishnah, so if you ask Rav Papa, he would say that was Rav Malkiyah. Rav Bibi Bar Habaya, now back to the subject. Rav Bibi Bar Habaya said, "Kapit afilo arivde de kusflinta." He would get very upset, even if you put a little bit of this ash on a tiny little wound, even if it wasn't like an arm length wound. You had a little incision, and you put this ash on, be tiny, so it wouldn't look like a tattoo. It wouldn't look like letters. He would still have a problem with you doing that, which is, I say, why there's such a taboo against tattoos in Jewish life, rabbinically. It's seen as deeply problematic. Ravashi, Ravashi says, Kol makam sheisham makam akdam mechich alav. Ravashi disagrees and say, wherever you've got a wound, everybody knows it's not a tattoo, it's just a wound. So there's debate back and forth about this. But again, it seems to be that tattooing is a deeply emblematic way of signaling detachment from Jewish life, and it seems to be problematic. There are cases, what if somebody is not Jewish? Are they allowed to do tattoos if they're not Jewish? Yeah, let's say it's not out of devotion to an idol. They just want to put it to, I love my mom, with a big heart and something through it. They're allowed to do that? Yeah. So what happens if they then say, I'd like to convert? Do they have to remove it? Or is it the act of doing it that's a problem? And now you're converting, you keep it. You still love your mom. And, you know, she's probably a little bit torn about the fact that you're converting and doesn't know what to do with that. So if you then remove the I love my mom, that might make it worse. So there are questions about that. And this comes back to the issue of whether you need to remove tattoos or not. And the same thing if somebody's a Baal Tshuva, say, look, I did it years ago. Do I have to remove it now or not? Does it get in the way? And
there's
if
a common belief that if you have a tattoo, you can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery. A lot of people think that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. There's a famous Larry David on that. That's all shown on it.
Really?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think it's not true.
That? That they don't
want to
bury whatever.
Yeah.
Was it Larry David? There was a new movie put up on Netflix a few weeks ago.
It was one of the shows. There was
a new movie with what's the name, Louis Dreyfus in it, where this comes up with somebody sitting in shul and the grandmother leans over and says, "You're not going to be buried in a Jewish cemetery because of something or another." But okay, you'll have to remind me of where in Curb that comes up.
I guess the question is that true?
It may be communal practice in places. It's not biblically prohibited. It may be that there are places that won't bury you if you have a tattoo, but it has not come to my desk, let's say. And my understanding is if it is, it would be kind of if it came to it, people would bury you. But they may, like, not stop this from spreading because they want people to take it seriously. But Larry, sounds like you may know better than I do about it.
One of my colleagues came to me very upset. She had tattoos. And she said, what should I do? Somebody told me I'm not going to be buried in Jewish cemetery. So I said, I don't know of any source for that.
Right. And at that point, you won't be so worried, presumably. Not you, she.
Well, she, yeah.
I mean, that'll be the last thing on your mind at the time. But so there we go. Maybe this is a.
Wilson, I one of my partners actually has not been getting a tattoo for the 75 years he's been alive because of that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I didn't go tell him it wasn't true.
Right. So I think people are reluctant to disabuse people of this idea.
I'm not a rabbi.
Right.
Feel it's a good deal, right?
No, it's an interesting idea that that's what's preventing him. This is not someone who's religious in any particular way, shape, or form, but
very interesting.
Here it is, 2002. Larry works in New York and returns to learn his mother died and was buried in an area for criminals because she had a tattoo. So he plots to have her
exhumed. And
yes, if you're interested, I'll tell you the episode.
There you go.
That's
very funny. So I guess this is more widely known. It does not seem to be rooted in the original discussion, but I can well imagine that over the years this became a way of distinguishing who's in and who's out. As there are a number of ways over the years where people define how are you in the Jewish community, where things that if you just look at the biblical sources, it seems like a peripheral issue, but it becomes a signal of communal devotion because that was how you expressed your Judaism or how you didn't. And in a world where everybody's getting tattoos and it's literally on your skin, it's the most visible thing. It's like almost a way of saying, I'm not Jewish if you put it on your body. So you can imagine people saying, yeah, this isn't because of like the biblical prohibition on tattoos. This is like the rush at the Seder. You're asking, you're doing something that demonstrates you're not in. You don't want to be in, you're out. I could imagine people making those claims, but again, it had not come to my deep attention. Okay, new Mishnah, where we'll come to the society caring about what's in your head. Nazir, shall I show to Yan Kaliyom? If a Nazir, this is Mishnah number 5, if the Nazir drinks all day long, en chai vel achat, it's one prohibition. You can from morning till night drink away, even though you're prohibited from drinking, and you're liable for one crime. Unless, Amrilo al tishte, if somebody keeps saying, if you drink that, you will be guilty of a crime, and there are two witnesses. And in between glugs, you go, I know. So you'll be guilty of a crime. I know. And then you drink again. You're performing multiple crimes. So it's the same behavior. You're drinking from 9 till 5 in either case, but you're just demonstrating verbally that mentally you're recommitting this crime each time. So we care what you're thinking. And the only reason you're not liable for a crime if you drink all day long without warnings is because we can't pin on you that we know that's what you were thinking. You're still committing crime. You're doing the same number of glugs, same number of drinking. You're breathing in between your drink. But if we don't say, don't do that, and you say, I know, we can't guarantee what's in your head. And now we're going to apply that same rule to other issues as well. If you're a Nazir, you can't become impure to the dead either. And if you sit kind of becoming impure to the dead all day long, which again, it's an odd activity, drinking all day, you can, you know, people do that. Being metame to the dead is an odd thing to do all day long, but I guess it would be if you're sitting in a cemetery or you're sitting in a wing of a hospital. Or to put a more sympathetic turn on this, a good friend has passed away and you're so aggrieved you refuse to leave their side and you sit by them all day long. It's one crime. If somebody comes along and says, you need to leave, you need to leave, you need to leave, you say, I know, but I can't, I need to be here. You are now liable for each and every verbalization that this is a crime. If you get a haircut all day, which for some of us is not really plausible, unless it's incredibly slow, you are only liable once. I'll do a little bit. If somebody says, stop cutting your hair, stop shaving, and you do it again, you're in trouble. If you wear kilayim all day long, you're wearing a mixture of wool and linen, it's one crime. If somebody says, don't wear that, and this is going to be a key turn of phrase, but you take it off and put it on again, you're liable for each and every one. Now this is kind of a distinct case. When we say drinking, that's something you do and you stop and you do. And if you do it repeatedly while being warned, each one is a crime. Matame lemesim is you keep touching somebody and they say, don't touch them again, you'll be in trouble, and you touch them, it's a crime. But if you keep doing that without warning, it's one crime. Wearing kilayim, I'm wearing my jacket, it's kilayim. Someone says, you can't wear that. Say, I know. Okay, one. You haven't taken it off, you're just sitting still. You can't wear that. Say, I know. Is that a crime, not taking it off? Or do I have to actively do something? So that's going to be what's at stake. And the Mishnah sounds like poshet velovesh. If you take it off and put it on, you're liable. If you just wear it all day, it's one crime. Going into the Mishnah, now here's the culmination.
Why are they, the obvious question is why do they need all these examples? I can understand the poshet velovesh maybe being different, but the first thing we seem identical. Does Gemara ask that question?
It does not, but the commentators do, and the commentators on the Mishnah do, in the Mishnah, like the Rambam and others. But it's a great question. Why is it
typical Gemara type of Shaka Vataria, right? Why do we need all three and then make a distinction in terms of they don't go into that?
Right.
It's very hard.
Yeah. You're invited to. When I'm at YU and people ask questions that are good questions, I don't have an answer to. I'll say presentation at the end of semester. So when we finish and give a presentation. So Yeshcharish Shalom Echad, you can do one furrow of plowing. V'chayv alav mishum shmona lavin, and you will be liable for 8 prohibitions. So this is like the culmination. We've said you're doing one act all day long. It's one crime, but if you get repeatedly warned, it will be multiple crimes. And now you can do one act, get 2 animals to pull for 1 meter, and you are going to get lashed 8 times. And when we get to the next stuff, and we're going to end a couple lines up from the bottom. The next stuff will start asking, what happens if you do 18 crimes? And the doctor, how many markers are you going to get for 18 crimes? 39 times 18. What if the doctor says they can only get 22, otherwise it'll kill them? So we put a cap when the doctor says. So what do you do? Do you just say, okay, you're going to get 22 of the first set, and then we're going to wait until you recover and then give you the next set? Or do we say, okay, these 22 are divided over the 18, so you've like, you know, 1 1/5 for each crime. So we're going to have a debate about how that works on the next page, and then we're going to get to how did you perform this? What did the whip look like? How were you positioned? What posture did you take during the lashing, et cetera, et cetera? What happens if accidentally the court whipper, there's got to be a better, you know, they'd have a modern turn of phrase, What do you call the profession people who collect the garbage?
Garbage.
So in England, these are called the bin men. I guess the garbage men, but I think Ronnie just said, what are they called now?
Sanitation workers.
So in England, they're now called refuse coordinators. So they're, you know, so court whipper. There has to be a better name than court whipper. But there'll be a discussion. What happens if accidentally the court whipper gets carried away and the whippee doesn't say whoopee, but ends up passing away because of this? Are they liable for that? Are they not liable for that? If you give one more lash than is necessary, etc., etc. So the Mishnah finishes. You can do one act and be chayv for 8 crimes. Number one, achorish b'shov chamor. You can do kilayim, which is plowing with these 2 animals and not allowed to be plowing together. Number two, hein mukdashim. That's also number 3, where each of these animals is considered sacred. And the Gemara will determine why these are sacred. And that's two different crimes, because each animal is sacred. So you've got kilayim, the use of kodshim, number 2 and 3. Kilei akerem. And what is kilei akerem? That's planting seeds that are mixed together. Now remember, what are you doing? What is this act? You've got a donkey and an ox plowing the floor. One act, nothing more. How could that be kilayim? Kilei akerem. How could that be planting seeds together?
The seeds are on the ground.
Now, where?
Now in front of it, and they mix them as they're going along.
Okay, so that's essentially where we'll come to, which is an odd way to do it, but it's one of the only ways the Gemara is going to settle what this might mean. And it's not the first intuition of the Gemara. So, uva shviat, it's also during Shemitah, where you're not allowed to maintain the land. The Yom Tov, and it's Yom Tov, and you're plowing on Yom Tov. Now, why does it say Yom Tov and not Shabbos? Shabbos would... Right, Shabbos, you don't get Malkus. You get something worse, depending on which you define as worse. You get something different, let's say. Yom Tov, you get Malkus. V'choen, v'nazir, and you're a priest, and you're a nazir, b'beit ha'tumah, and it's in a cemetery. So you've got an ox and a donkey in a cemetery where you're plowing with forbidden seeds on Yom Tov. I mean, you've got to be seriously trying to do this. And what the Mishnah is saying is, this is at minimum. Of course, if you had 14 donkeys and 14 oxen, you could get many, many more for this one act. We're saying, but there is one act where at minimum you would get 8 for this one behavior. Again, you have to have somebody standing there warning you for all 8 and witnesses. And you have to go, I know. You're in trouble. Chanan ben Achinai Omer, Afalovish Kalaim said, hold on a minute, let's make this 9. How could we make this 9? You're wearing kalaim at the same time. Which point the Gemara says, Amalo Eina Hashem. The Gemara says, well, hold on a minute, that's not the same act. Meaning there you're liable for what you're wearing. Everything else is this plowing was the problem. At which point the Gemara is going to say, hold on a minute, you think wearing kalaim, you're being like punished for what you're wearing, not what you're doing. Which other issues should we now remove from the calculus? Amalahen Af Nazir Lord Hashem. Meaning Nazirim are allowed to plow, you're just not allowed to be in a cemetery. So it's not the act of plowing the problem, it's that you're in there that's the problem. So the Gemara is going to have to debate why the first view considers that to be part of plowing as opposed to wearing kilayim, which is different.
Why Nazir and not Kohen?
That is a good question, which you don't need to give a presentation on, because if you look at Rashi, the first wide line of Rashi, at the big block, Af Nazir, Nazir, the Kohen come of Lodak. It means both, but he's not being precise. I imagine there are others who would disagree and say there's something specific about the Nazir, but that's the way Rashi reads it. Gemara. So you said you've got to take on, talking about the case of you're wearing kalaim and you wear it all day. It's one crime unless you take it on and off. So do you actually literally have to take the cloak off and put it back on? Or what if you just like take your hand in and out of the sleeve? Is that enough? Machave Ravacha Breda of Ika. So we've got Ravacha Breda Ravacha again demonstrating. You have to slip in and out of it. What does that mean? You've got to take it off and put it on, or it means you've got to put your arm in and out the sleeve? Yeah, we have no idea, and both those views exist, debating on whether he's saying you need to take it off and off, or you just slip in and out. Ravashi Yom, Ravashi Salfilo Shai, Lekidei Lifshot V'Lodrosh Chayev, and this is how we rule, which is why it doesn't quite matter for legal purposes what Ravacha was demonstrating. We say, well, actually, you don't have to take it off at all. You just have to be wearing it long enough that you could have taken it on and off, and that's enough to be criminally liable. Yesh Chom Telem. You are liable if you plowed one plow for 8 different rules. And Rabbi Yana says, "B'chabru nimnu gamru." They made this Rabbi Yanai, who's about to be supported by Rabbi Yochanan, and then Rabbi Yanai is going to turn to Rabbi Yochanan and say, "Oh, that's so sweet you supported me, and I have to tell you, I wouldn't have known that support without you telling me this, because I would have read the Mishnah differently. So thank you." And then we're going to end this view. So Amr the green. Amr Rabbi Yanai says, "B'chabru nimnu gamru." They had a constitutional congress. There's a view that a number of rabbinic decisions were made in what we could call constitutional congresses, where they got together and said, there's an ambiguity here, how do we feel? Nimna v'gamru, they voted and they concluded, achofa b'klaim loka. What happens if you've got seeds, grape seeds and wheat seeds lying on the floor? Usually sowing involves putting them into a trough. What happens if they're lying on the floor and I just dump soil on it? Is that planting? Is that sowing or not? And they decided, loka, that is, hachofik lam, covering it up is malchus. That was Rabbi Yonah. Amalei Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan said, Rabbi Yonah, it's very nice of you to say that, but you don't have to think that was like a later constitutional congress. Love Mishnah Tainu, that's what our Mishnah says. It says, yeshchosh telem echad v'chayv v'la mishnah mishnah v'lavim. You do one thing, you get chayv for 8 crimes. Hachosh b'shav v'chamor, you're doing kilai behema. V'hin mukdashim, they are mukdashim, so you're getting 1, 2, 3. V'kilayim bekerim, you say kilai kerim. And now we interrupt and say, what does this mean? Achorish machayim mishim kilayim. How can you be chai for kilayim just from plowing? You need to sow things. Heich mishkach Allah. It must be, love de michasai bahadei da azel. It must be, as you're plowing along, the soil that's being displaced is now covering the seeds. So you're in that one act also sowing seeds. Amalei Rabbi Yonah responded, says, oh, he loved it, Laila Chaspa. If I wouldn't have lifted up this shard, Mimishkacha Maganita Tuta, would you have found this wonderful pearl underneath? Basically saying, that's an amazing teaching. I'm glad I said what you think is obvious, because if I'd not said that, I wouldn't have read the Mishnah that way. So by having this discussion, we uncovered this together. Amalei Rav Lakish Rabbi Yochanan, And Reish Lakish says to Rabbi Yochanan, because if this great person, I mean, Rabbi Yonai, hadn't praised you, I would have read the Mishnah differently. I would have said, Mani Mani, who's the Mishnah? Rabbi Akiva. The only way to make sense is Rabbi Akiva, that actually you don't need to sow seeds to be liable for Kilai Kerem, you just need to maintain the field. My Rabbi Akiva, what does Rabbi Akiva say this? The Tanya taught in the Brayta, Menachash Rechav B'Chaim Loka, if you weed the ground of Kilayim, you have to do something active to weed it. Rabbi Akiva Amaf Makayim, because it's actually, you know, just maintaining the field is problematic. My time to Rabbi Akiva, and what's the reason for Rabbi Akiva? The Tanya taught in the Brayta, San Chalad Yisrael Kilayim, it says, in your field you shall not sow mixed seeds, en el zareya. That says sowing is a problem, Makayim, and how do I know that even sustaining them is a problem? Talmud Loma, and you've got to ignore the brackets here. Oh, well, you've got to kind of hold on to the brackets, I guess. The pasuk which describes Kilai Kerem has Kilai Behema right next to Kilai Kerem. And the formulation of the verse has the words Kilayim surrounding the word Sad Chalo. So this is Behem Chalo Tarbir Kilayim. You can't mix up two animals, full stop. Sad Chalo Tizrai Kilayim. And your field you can't plant with Kilayim. And the fact that there's the order of the verse has the words Kilayim Sad Chalo Tizrai Kilayim. Kilayim Sad Chalo comes together, makes it sound like your field cannot have any mixtures in it at all, which means even maintaining them. We'll do like three quick lines here, so that next time we'll pick up. Amalei Ravula Rav Nachman. Ravula says, hold on a minute. The Mishnah said 8 prohibitions. Well, let's get another one in there for one act. Lilkinam Mishnah Zoreya Yom Tov. You're also not allowed to plant on Yom Tov. And if you're now telling me this is a form of Zoreya because you're covering the seeds with the earth, so this is a minimum of 9, because not only are you plowing on Yom Tov, you're also sowing on Yom Tov. Amalei Tana V'Shaya, so the Gemara says, yeah, you're right, but he didn't include everything. At which point the Gemara says, really? He seemed quite extreme on including everything. Amalei Tana K'tani Shmona V'Azamra Tana V'Shaya. He listed 8 different things, and you're telling me he left them off? He sounds quite pedantic, or he seems like he's trying to make a point. He's not going to leave anything out. Rava responds, Yishchalot Melach B'Shod V'Yinchalot Melach B'Yom Tov. Very important distinction that on Shabbos you are liable for each and every malacha you perform separately. On Yom Tov, you'll have once for breaking Yom Tov, even if you do multiple malachas. Amalei Ada Tahei, he says, yeah, you're right. And now the Gemara is going to, Abai is going to push back and say, really? Don't we make a chiluk malachas in Yom Tov? And we're going to spend a couple of lines talking about Yom Tov, and then we'll transition into how to apply malchus. But in the meantime, we've now done Mishnah 4 and 5. We're getting closer and closer to the home straight. We'll be wrapping up these 3 parakim with the laughter of Rabbi Akiva. And the aim is to do the same on Shavuos. I hope, please God, you'll be available to be here on Shavuos, and we'll do that together. If not, let me know, and we'll find an alternative. But otherwise...